Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Digitally Uploaded podcast. I'm Matt Sansbury. I'm the editor-in-chief of digitallydownloaded.net, as usual. And with me this week, we have Ginny. Hello, Ginny. How are you doing?
Good, thanks, Matt. How about you?
I'm alive. And we've also got Trent. Hello, Trent. How's things?
Good. I'm also alive.
Yeah, it's always good to be alive. Alive is better than the other thing. Okay, so we got heaps to talk about this week, even though there wasn't too much news. We've found filler content. Filler content's always good stuff. And I use the word content twice in like a sentence. I feel dirty now. But yeah, we've got plenty to talk about. We'll listen to some music and then we'll get stuck into it. This week, our Miku track is Senbon Sakura. I know I've played this a whole bunch of times, but it's my favorite Miku track, so you can just sit back and listen to it. We'll be back after the music and enjoy. And welcome back, everyone. Okay, so the first section of the podcast this week, we're going to talk about history games, but also more generally games that kind of encourage us to learn a bit after we finish playing the game. I've started a series of YouTube videos looking at samurai warriors and the various real world history backgrounds to those games. And one of the reasons I'm such a fan of Samurai Warriors is when I first played Samurai Warriors 3 back on the Wii. That was my first Warriors game. And after playing that, I got so inspired to learn about everything that the game depicted that I ended up spending ages and ages and ages reading about the various historical warlords, getting books on the subject, learning about Sengoku period. And that really kicked off a love of Japanese history and culture and stuff for me in a way that I hadn't experienced before. So that was quite inspiring for me. And I would hope that there are a lot of other games out there that if encourage people to learn beyond the game and really get something out of it. So I thought that would be a good topic to talk about this week, given that there's a bit of news out there about some new Dynasty Warriors features for the upcoming Dynasty Warriors 9. And not too long ago, the Creative Assembly and Sega announced that they're doing a Total War game based in China during the Three Kingdoms period. So there's a lot of history stuff floating around at the moment, and I thought it'd be a good discussion. So, Ginny, have you ever played a game that's kind of, that after playing it, you then kind of felt inspired to go and learn a lot of stuff? It doesn't have to be about history, of course, but just generally speaking.
Well, yeah. However, it's not a Dynasty game. It's actually Hakuoki. For those that are uninitiated, Hakuoki is a visual novel style romance dating game where you get to romance some very eligible samurai bachelors. And yeah, so I went to Hakuoki sort of expecting like a sort of typical, I guess, shonen dating sim. I knew it was set in historical Japan, but I didn't really know if it was just sort of flavored with Japanese history, if it was sort of reflective of any events of Japanese history. And I was pleasantly surprised. So as I was playing through, there were other people at DDNet that have played the game before, and I was chatting like, oh, you know, I've just done this and done this to this guy. And then Matt was like, hey, you should look up who this guy actually is. So I looked at some of the characters and some of the events that get portrayed in the game, like certain battles and certain alliances between different samurai warriors that actually happened in real life. So I thought that was really interesting. I was not super experienced with visual novels at the time, and just sort of like the way that Hakuoki sort of really seamlessly integrated its rather outlandish plot about demons with sort of Japanese history, I found that really interesting. And I actually went away after that and I looked up every single person that I romanced in the game because I wanted to see what they were actually like in real life. Obviously, they looked nothing like the shoujo guys that were in the game, but a lot of their acts and even their personalities seem to match up with what they were like historically. So Hakuoki really is the game, I guess, that sparked my interest in that particular era, because previously I just had zero knowledge of the Shinsengumi and like the samurai, any of that sort of rich Japanese history. I just had no clue. So I found Hakuoki really, really informative. Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, for listeners who might not be so familiar with Japanese history, Hakuoki takes place during the period of the Shinsengumi, which was an interesting period of Japanese history. The country had just been forcibly opened up from the Americans kind of coming along and demanding that they end their period of isolation. The period of isolation came directly as a result of the Sengoku period, which is my bit of history. That's where the Samurai Warriors series is set. After that, bit of civil war finished up. There was a couple of hundred years of isolation. Then, as I said, the Americans came along, and that was the period that the Shinsengumi came around. So, yeah, those two periods are particularly popular amongst Japanese pop culture when it comes to history, and they generally show up in in video games and film and so on quite a lot for people who are listening along. Rurouni Kenshin is also set basically that same period, I think. So, yeah, it is. So, yeah, there's a lot of material out there based on those two periods of history, which is interesting. And I certainly recommend anybody who plays these games go and learn a bit more about them, because they are interesting. What about you, Trent? Is there any games that you've played in the past and afterwards you've kind of gone and done research and learned a lot more about the topic?
Not really, because most of the games I focus on playing are more fantasy-orientated, so there's not really a real-world base in a lot of the games I usually play. I guess the Assassin's Creed series is one which sort of has historical locations, and Origins is one which has a big push in terms of being a bit more historically accurate in regards to the Egyptian landmarks and stuff. So that's, you know, something, you know, I found a little bit more information about there. Just by playing the game. And obviously that's also got a big push with the PC release of just a standalone that educational version of the game, which seems like an interesting way to sort of push even other gamers or non-gamers into the area and be like, oh, well, this is from a game, but this is still an educational experience to understand various topics which were actually portrayed properly. So I haven't directly looked into things lately, but there are games which I've played, like Origins, which have, you know, that sort of, you know, experience in regards to them and in the game itself, where there's a lot of content where you do actually learn things as you're playing them. So
yeah, I mean, Origins is a really interesting one. For the longest time, my biggest the biggest reason I played the Assassin's Creed games has been because of the way that they depict history, and the people at Ubisoft are obviously very keen historians in their own right, and they go to a lot of effort to really make the environments authentic to the period of time and depicting, you know, real historical events and so on, even while there's that ridiculous battle between Assassins and Templars going on in the foreground. But yeah, it obviously Origins is the first time I think Ubisoft has really decided that there's value in the games as educational material, and that educational edition, the non-violent and historically focused release of Origins, is a really fascinating one, and certainly something I hope to see more developers do when they do focus on creating periods of history in their games. If they can give people the real historical context as well in some way, then I think that's a valuable thing.
Yeah, that new history mode that they're introducing, where the game will just be released purely in its history form. I found that really entertaining, actually. I think that would be quite good.
I think it's really cool. I think it's something that then schools can consider bringing in.
Oh, and, yeah,
you know,
course.
Encouraging kids to learn about, you know, Egypt through something that's still going to be very visually exciting and, you know, interesting and engaging for them. But, you know, it's much more interesting for kids, I guess, to see that than read a stuffy old book, unfortunately. It would be nice if more kids read books, but if they're not going to read books, then, you know, this kind of thing might inspire them to then go and learn a little bit more, which is really cool.
Well, a big push in educational areas is obviously STEM stuff and, you know, things which kids are a lot more hands-on. So, you know, having seen a little bit of that firsthand, you know, it's definitely something which could easily be pushed into a curriculum and work in that environment. So definitely, if Ubisoft can push that into schools and say, look, we've got this game, or make more games which sort of use that environment to say, look, we've got a package which does this. Do you want to use this to teach, you know, kids about, you know, Egypt or another upcoming Assassin's Creed with like a different location, like Africa or something like that, and be like, we've got this package which has, you know, all these locations, but it's more educational experience and more visual, you know, experience for your kids, you know, maybe VR, you know, that's something they can easily, you know, definitely would be something which would work in a school environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And other things that would work, and, you know, they're things worth doing both in and outside of a school environment, and they're interesting and their learning experiences is, you know, stuff that's not directly teaching people, but encouraging them to learn skills and things like, for instance, last week, obviously, Nintendo announced the Labo product set, and those things are really good for kids because they encourage them to get hands-on and build things from blueprints, and it teaches all those kinds of you know, basic engineering and mathematics and construction and all those kinds of skills, which then they can build on, and you know, it inspires them to learn by doing it in a very fun and engaging way, and that's certainly a good thing. And another example would be SimCity. You know, I'm sure there are quite a few city planners out there who, you know, work in actual, you know, city planning, who as kids were playing SimCity and learning the basics about how, you know, how various parts of a city work together and how they play against each other and how traffic flows around and how, you know, you need to zone things around, zone things to make sure that you can, you know, deal with competing interests. And I'm sure, you know, City Skylines being the more recent SimCity, follow-on, spiritual sequel as such. Those kinds of things will hopefully inspire another generation. And there's a lot of learning that you can do through games and a lot of things that you can be inspired to take more seriously after you find a game particularly enjoyable, which is what we'd certainly like to see more of that and less of, you know, Call of Duty, encouraging people to learn things all the wrong way around, or rewriting history and falsely depicting history and encouraging people not to think. I think there's a lot of healthy stuff that games can be doing without being overt about it. Okay, so on that note, we might go to some music and come back with something a little bit different. The music this time is a little bit retro, I guess. Suikoden 3, Exceeding Love. Welcome back, everybody. Okay, so the other bit of news, the big release, I guess, that a lot of us are really looking forward to is Final Fantasy Dissidia, which is not too far away now. I believe, at least when we're recording this, there's the open beta, so people can get some hands-on time with it before it releases properly. And yeah, it's a really good fighting game, I think. I played it originally back in the arcades in Japan when I was there a couple of years ago, and really enjoyed it. And then I got on with the closed beta last year and really enjoyed it. So there's certainly things that are concerning to me. The roster is pretty terrible. None of my favorite characters are in the roster, which is just, I don't know how Square Enix managed to do that, because I got a lot of favorite Final Fantasy characters and they missed them all. And there's also no narrative, which is a little bit disappointing given that the PSP one, Dissidia 012, had a pretty fun narrative to make it worth your while playing at single player. But Anyway, putting all of that aside, as long as it plays well and there's a good online community, I think it'll be a pretty good game. But we thought we'd talk about that in the context of, you know, Final Fantasy spin-offs and so on, because we talk a lot about the numbered ones. We don't talk as much about the spin-offs, and I think a lot of those are, if anything, more worthwhile than the actual games. And I'm looking at Chocobo Dungeon then. Yeah, that's the best game to have the Final Fantasy name, as far as I'm concerned. I love it. Love it. Love it.
Of course. Of course.
Chocobo makes every game better, and it's just tragic that there isn't one on the Switch, at least. How can they not just HD up the Wii one and stick it on Switch?
That's a good point, actually. I would horrible definitely play oversight. The crap out of that. Yeah.
Yeah, horrible oversight. But what are your favorites? What are your favorite spin-offs from the Final Fantasy series over the years?
Definitely Theater Rhythm. I love rhythm games, so Theater Rhythm is definitely up there. Chocobo Dungeon as well, because I love games like Chocobo Dungeon and Pokemon Mystery Dungeon and stuff like that. Just and anything that looks adorable, actually, because the next one on my list was going to be World of Final Fantasy. I just think that the difference in aesthetic from the general Final Fantasy games is what originally made those games appealing to younger me, and that trend is kind of just kind of kept on going. For Theater Rhythm, though, I guess because it's a rhythm game, that's probably why it's the nearest and dearest to my heart. I love all the music from Final Fantasy. I've attended multiple Final Fantasy concerts, done write-ups on them, own most of the soundtracks. So the music has always really, really spoken to me. I have a musical background, so which is probably kind of why Theater Rhythm is also one of my favorites. I just think that even though it's a game with no narrative, which is usually something that kind of puts me off, the fact that I can play as pretty much any of my favorite characters and experience all those songs repeatedly, that really is the big draw. I played Dissidia on the PSP. Wasn't my favorite. I wouldn't call myself a huge fighting game buff, mainly because Dissidia doesn't run the soft engine. So I am not as incentivized to play it. But I definitely think that if you just think about the titles I've listed, even though all of my favorites have a similar, I guess, sort of cute, sometimes even chibi style, they're all vastly different genres of games, which I think sort of really speaks to the depth of the Final Fantasy series and how these spin-offs have all, I think, been quite commercially successful, despite being vastly different in aesthetic from the original and also game sense between one another.
Yeah, I mean, Square Enix obviously feels less pressure with these spin-offs to do that kind of really realistic, super high budget, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, leading experience and something that'll blow everybody out of the water, as it obviously does with Final Fantasy or, you know, 15 and all of that kind of stuff. So they tend to be a little bit more experimental and creative, and I think that's where you find a lot of the long-term Final Fantasy fans really find their love for the franchise continuing. They'll still play the likes of Final Fantasy 15 and stuff, but what keeps them coming back for more is that kind of creative edge from those earlier games. Like, for example, Final Fantasy Type Zero is, I think you could call that a spin-off, since it doesn't really belong to any of the numbered games. And and you know, what I loved about that in part was because it was on the PS4, but it pulled the kind of the aesthetic, that really the very zoomed out top down aesthetic from Final Fantasy 8 and 7 and 9, and really ran with that. So it looked, you know, put this in inverted commas, it looked ugly on the PS4. But as somebody who grew up with Final Fantasy, I love that. And I love that Square Enix was willing to do that with that game and still stick it out there as the first Final Fantasy on the PS4. Mm. And Chocobo Dungeon and Theater Rhythm are obviously very cute and charming. World of Final Fantasy is absolutely adorable, to the point where the first monster, because it's a monster hunting game, if you haven't played it, but the first monster you get is a chocobo chick, and I kept that chocobo chick in my party the entire game, even though yes, his stats weren't the best by the end of it.
They're terrible.
But I had to keep him in there because I felt bad if I left him out of the party after having him, because he's just so adorable.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, Trent, have you... I know you're not the world's biggest fan of Final Fantasy, but have you played any of the spin-offs over the years?
Well, the spin-offs are basically all I do play. The big thing about the spin-offs is, you know, I look at the numbered series and I'm like, well, is just daunting. You know, I never played Final Fantasy in the numbered games when I was younger. I had all the wrong consoles for that. I was more big on Nintendo, so I didn't have a PlayStation, so I didn't have, you know, the PlayStation Final Fantasies. And then just as I grow up, I just look at the numbered, I'm like, well, should I be playing this? Like, am I missing out on this game? And should I have backstory, which I need to know? And it just seems really daunting to look at the numbered games and be, you know, willing to invest or buy into the series when I feel like I'm missing a considerable amount of the universe by not playing those numbered games if I go and pick up another numbered game. So a lot of the games I've been playing in the Final Fantasy series are things like Theater Rhythm, the Tactics series, those sort of things, which are sidesteps for the developers and just release, you know, on a whim more. But they're, for me, they're the main Final Fantasy because, you know, they're enough to engross myself in the universe. But I don't feel like I'm missing a huge amount because it's not a numbered game and I feel like it's contained. And they're usually more experimental genres, as we mentioned before. And because of that, I'm usually experiencing games in a wider variety of types that Final Fantasy doesn't normally, you know, approach, which I might find a bit stressful or tiring after playing, you know, the 14th or the 15th version in that main series. So,
yeah, I mean, the good thing about Final Fantasy is that each game is distinct to one another. So, I mean, if you go and jump on Final Fantasy 12, for instance, you're not missing anything if you haven't played 11 through to 1 before it. And that's what I think has been a core reason that Final Fantasy has been so enduring over the years. But the one thing I will say is that I think might be a bit of a problem for you going forward, Trent, having not played a lot of these earlier Final Fantasy games. It seems to me that Square Enix is resting a lot on nostalgia for earlier games with these spin-offs more and more. So World of Final Fantasy, for an example, I would suggest that the experience is probably not the same if you haven't got a lot of experience with the numbered Final Fantasies, which is, it's both good for, I guess, long-term fans, but it's a little bit, I think it makes it a little bit difficult to step into that game if you haven't played the ones before. Dissidia is another example. Without knowing who the characters are, you're probably not going to enjoy that as much as if if you've played all the games before it. I think Square Enix probably knows that in the first place, only real Final Fantasy fans would buy into a game like that. But it definitely is, I think, there is an increasing barrier there for a lot of these spin-offs for people who haven't got that long heritage with the Final Fantasy series. And yes, they should put... I'm just hoping that there's an awful lot of DLC coming for Final Fantasy Dissidia with characters that I actually like.
I would like more events for Final Fantasy 15. I feel like the Assassin's Creed one was kind of lackluster. Give me a Monster Hunter event. You know, I want that.
Final Fantasy 15 needs to have like a spin-off with the women all having their own adventure because it's far too dude heavy.
Yeah, I think or we could just put them dead or alive 6. That would be also fine. With me.
No, I seriously think that there's real legs there for them to get the Iris and Sydney and Luna Freya together or something and have them do like an adventure set before the events of Final Fantasy 15 or something.
Yeah, even like chapters, like Luna Freya chapter, like how they did one for Ignis and Prompto and stuff. That would be quite nice.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be difficult without giving away spoilers because of what happens to Luna Freya, but you know.
Yeah. We can dream.
We can dream. Maybe a Final Fantasy 15 2 or 15-0. There you go.
15 times 0.
15-0, like a prequel, like Resident Evil 0 or something like that. Anyway, on that note, we'll go to some music from Final Fantasy 12, Rabanasta Downtown, which is a great track, great game. Still highly recommend that one to anybody who has a PS4. I hope it sold well. I want a sequel. Final Fantasy 12 2. That would be cool. We'll be right back. And welcome back, everybody. Okay, so last week we started a new feature on the podcast where we look at one specific game and talk about it deeply as possible in the time that we have. Last week was Dark Souls, and this week we're going really, really, really retro. We are going to have a look at Space Invaders, the original and still the best, arguably. But I think anybody who has played games has surely played Space Invaders in some form or another. Surprisingly enough, it's actually difficult to play the original Space Invaders on current consoles. I don't think it's on any of them at the moment. I think you can get it on your iPad, which is not the ideal way to play Space Invaders, unfortunately. I don't think it's on PC even. I mean, you can get clones and stuff, but I don't think the original Space Invaders is there. But yeah, it's a game that I love. It's a game I've been playing ever since I've been playing games. It's a game I still play regularly. I've got my arcade cabinet, and of the 15,000 games or whatever that are sitting on it, I just find myself going back to Space Invaders over and over again. It's quite a relaxing way to spend a couple of hours just shooting these things. But the reason I wanted to talk about Space Invaders, firstly, there is Space Invaders Extreme coming out on PC in the near future, so hopefully there's a bit more interest put back into that franchise again. But also I wanted to talk about, you know, the importance of Space Invaders and the value of it, and why it's still quite a good game to look at now, why it's still a game worth playing now. And, you know, it kind of, for me, it stands as a good example of how quite minimalist gameplay and aesthetics and all of that can still be very compelling when it's done tightly and it's done well. And it's just amazing to think that the developers who originally made that game, how much work they would have had to have gone through to do it, when you could do a Space Invaders clone in about 3 minutes on Game Maker now. But yeah, Ginny, I mean, I'm assuming that you've played Space Invaders at some point in your life.
Yeah, I have played it at some point in my life. I played it at an arcade, actually, last year on an ancient machine.
Oh, wow, the real experience.
So, yeah, I mean, it was like I went for someone's birthday party and they booked out this arcade and there were just a bunch of sort of old pinball machines and other old arcade games. I think there was a Pac-Man machine there as well. There was a Pong machine and there was a Space Invaders machine. So, I had played Space Invaders previously before that, but I think it was up on a Play Store app, so probably the one that you were just talking about, Matt, on the iPad. So I played it originally in a format like that, or with some other... I think I had like a Space Invaders console type thing when I was a kid that was kind of like a Nintendo, but it only played like Space Invaders and Pong. It might have been a bootleg thing that I got in Asia, who knows? But I played some form of that game growing up. And it was quite weird to me, actually, playing it again recently as an adult. And it's still being interesting. I mean, I'm not one of those like, oh, 60 FPS. Like, I need to see like a bead of sweat on the person's face to like a game. But I guess I'd always thought that the premise was so simple that maybe I wouldn't be captured by it again as someone who has since, you know, I first played the game, played plenty of other games that are incredibly compelling and incredibly detailed and beautiful. But it just sucks you in. I don't know what it is, but I think Space Invaders occupies a very nostalgic time in history that almost everyone can identify with. Like, I mean, the graphics are beyond simple. The concept, beyond simple. But the game still finds a way to build momentum and tension despite those factors.
Well, I think part of it is that, as simple as it is, it's actually a really good-looking game, and I think that's where, you know, people need to start having that discussion about, or being able to define the difference between, you know, high-fidelity graphics, which is what you have in modern consoles, and good art direction, and those three, you know, different alien designs that are the bulk of the graphics in Space Invaders. They are absolutely iconic because they are so well designed, and they are so effective at creating a certain tone and theme and so on. I mean, they're still the logo of the company that created it. Taito's logo is one of the Space Invaders. You go, t-shirt, you go to a gamer shop that has like heaps of t-shirts, you're almost certainly going to find one that has the Space Invaders character on it. That's, to me, that's art direction, and that's where, you know, Space Invaders still remains a really good-looking game, whereas a lot of other retro games, you know, you wouldn't know about them because they didn't do that art direction so effectively. despite the minimal resources. So, yeah, I think when we talk about retro games, we need to not try and compare them to modern games, or not say that they're simple so much as they have that kind of, whether they have that art direction that means that they're still beautiful to look at today. Because I agree with you, I think that Space Invaders does an amazing job at creating tension while you're playing. I think the graphics are one thing. I think that three or four note, how many notes?
Yeah, it's like a four note loop that is.
Yeah,
I sort of recognize that instantly. Like I could be anywhere, like a department store. If someone played that music, like it would just take me right back into that moment of playing the game again. Like it's a very
iconic.
It's
amazingly tense. It's like it has that very, it has that hostile sound to it.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's like the Jaws theme almost.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it has that really hostile tone, and it has that coldness that you would. You imagine, you know, these invaders from space coming down, they're, high technology and all that kind of stuff, and they're cold and they're alien and they're very different. And that those four notes that is that entire soundtrack really create that atmosphere, which is amazing. And it's quite tense. I agree. The other thing I picked up on what you said there was the experience itself of actually playing Space Invaders. I think, you know, it's easy, you know, if they were to stick it on a console now and you just kind of load it up on your TV and play it, it would not be the same as sitting down in front of an arcade machine with those, you know, tactile buttons and the control stick and actually putting the coin in to the machine. I think that's a big thing as well. Because, yeah, the tension is that much more ramped up if you've just paid for the chance to play the game, if that makes
exactly.
sense.
Yeah.
I think a lot of those old arcade games, we lose that a lot. When we talk about them now, and we talk about them, you know, when we played them on the PS4 or whatever, where you've got unlimited credits and you don't need to pay to use them. Obviously, arcade games were built around that experience of actually paying at the moment to play, and that adds something to what you feel while you're playing the game. And without that, there's a disconnect there. So I think it's a little bit unfortunate that there aren't so many arcades around anymore, because there is a certain arcade game experience that can't be replicated on consoles,
for consoles. Sure.
And Space Invaders is certainly one example of that. So, yeah, if you get a chance to, if you ever see it somewhere, you know, in a corner of an arcade or a shopping mall or something, and there's a Space Invaders table there, definitely play it, because that's the way to go with it.
Even in a regional city, which has like a small town complex, we're not going to have arcade machines anywhere anytime soon.
No, it's true. It's true. Arcades are basically dead. I did actually get to play Space Invaders on an original arcade machine once in Japan. There was a little arcade I found that still had the Space Invaders on a machine. That was pretty cool. But yeah. Okay, so Trent, what are your thoughts on Space Invaders?
Well, I don't think I've actually played an arcade version of it at all. I think I've only played things like Flash remakes or, you know, as you said earlier, Game Maker, you know, versions of it where, you know, they can be knocked up in 3 minutes, so they're just all over the internet. So I don't think I've actually ever played the original or one from that era, which is probably a shame, but, you know, the gameplay is still there. But yeah, it's interesting. I remember a lot of games from that around when Space Invaders came out, and that's, you know, the earlier generations after that. And it's one of the games which stands out for me. You know, I can think of things like Adventure on the Atari systems and that sort of, you know, games like that. And then, you know, a few other titles which have that similar sort of aesthetic. But Space Invaders, Pac-Man, those sort of more simple 2D games, you know, they really stand out and stand, the test of time where, you know, as I said earlier, they're on T-shirts, you know, they're easily recognizable. They're essentially the graphics design they've got on them it's a brand in its own self. So, yeah, that's, you know, pop culture-wise, a lot of my, you know, experience with Space Invaders is, you know, through pop culture. And it's not necessarily playing the game or knowing, oh, there's Space Invaders on a T-shirt. Oh, that's cool. That sort of stuff. But, yeah, I've played the game, and I've also played the Steam version. Not Steam version, the Space Invaders Extreme, which is coming out. So I know of, you know, how it plays, but, yeah, it's just mostly stuff is pop culture-wise, how I've, you know, injected and experienced Space Invaders.
Yeah, It's interesting, isn't it? It's Space Invaders, I think, came out before I was even born, so we are talking about a very old game here. But it would seem that younger generations might never get the chance to really play Space Invaders as it was meant to be played, which is obviously very unfortunate. The basic gameplay still exists in a lot of games, but even emulations, even recreations of the original game, Taito doesn't seem to be very interested in doing that, which is a very sharp contrast to Namco and Pac-Man, because Pac-Man is basically available everywhere, and every new console that comes out has the original Pac-Man recreated on it in some form. I assume that Namco does that because it's an easy way to get some money from people. But it's a very different strategy to Taito, because Taito doesn't put Space Invaders out anywhere, and it's getting harder and harder to play Space Invaders as Taito originally designed it. To give everybody an example, the original Space Invaders scoring is particularly hard, because the way that each new level works when the aliens reset, it gets much more difficult very quickly, to the point where, as much as I play Space Invaders, my arcade machine, I think my score is over 4,000, just over 4,000, 4,010 or something, and I haven't been able to beat that in about 6 months. So that's a lot of the remakes of Space Invaders, or the redesigns of Space Invaders, or the cheap clones of Space Invaders make scoring much easier. And that's not the experience that Space Invaders was meant to be about. Scoring was meant to be difficult. Those little things, or what seem like little things, result in a very different experience. And I guess I'm concerned that people won't ever get, younger generations especially, won't ever get a chance to experience that. They know what Space Invaders is because it's such an iconic thing, but they won't actually get to experience Space Invaders, which is unfortunate. So at the I think that pretty much wraps up everything we had to say about Space Invaders. It's a good game. I love it. So I was glad to have a chance to talk about it today. Thanks to Ginny and Trent for popping on the podcast this week. Thanks everybody for listening. We do a bit of music to round things out. We've picked Kirby's Smash Brothers music thingy because Kirby's great, Smash Brothers is great, and music is great. Thanks very much for listening in, and we'll catch you next week.